On this Memorial Day, I think of the situation 50 years ago. 50 years ago, I was ordained to the gospel ministry in the summer of that year. 50 years ago, I was installed in the first church that I pastored in New Haven, Connecticut. What a different world it was then. There was Stalin's Russia. There was Hitler's Germany. And the thousand-year Reich is now long past. And the Stalinist USSR is long past, too. So now we have emerged from the shadows, right? And we've emerged into the sunshine. The world at last is safe for democracy or something of that sort, right? You know, in France, there's a sign they have at railroad crossings. It says, you know, in our crossings, it might say, look both ways. But in France, it's a little more sophisticated and maybe more direct. It says, watch out, one train may conceal another. You got it? One train may conceal another. And you know, as Christians, on an occasion like this, when we look to the future, we do have to think about the realities of this situation. And therefore, the words of Paul come to us, I think, with unusual force, because there is another train barreling down the track. At this time, there's a TV program running on public television in the Southern California area where we live. I don't know if it's been shown here. It's called Millennium, and it's a very beautiful presentation. It's put on by an anthropologist, David Mayberry Lewis. And the theme of it is that we must get away from what he regards as the old mythology on which our civilization has been based, that is to say, the Christian faith. And he says the trouble with our faith has been that it's us over against them, man is over against nature. Whereas man really ought to realize that he's just a part of nature. And he tells us that since Nietzsche has told us that God is dead, since Freud has discovered the unconscious, since Darwin has shown us the evolution of the species, and since the physicists have told us that all truth is relative, it's time that we came up with a new myth for a new millennium. And that's why the name Millennium. So what is that religion that we ought to have for the next thousand years? Well, he says we're in the void between the death of one proud God and the rebirth of many. And the series of programs is looking at the tribal religions to find in them the basis of the new mythology that we need. He describes a young man from the Mucuna tribe in the equatorial South America who went out of the tribal setting to have a Western education and who now comes back to be with his father, a shaman who shares a spirit with the jaguar. And this young man is trying to enter in again to that mythology that he had left behind. And so as the spirit dancers come in and do their dance and incantations, he tries to see the spirits. And he isn't quite able, except perhaps at one moment he has a glimpse of a spirit. And the challenge put to us is, why not a new myth? Treating all life as part of our own being, developing reverence for that person or that vegetable at a deeper and more spiritual level. Spiritual unity with the vegetables. But you see, this is seriously proposed because it's said to be what is needed for the ecology of the mind. Well, friends, as Christians, we should be concerned about our stewardship in this earth, about ecology, yes. But Paul tells us there's a different basis for it. What the Apostle Paul presents to us is the exclusive claim of Jesus Christ, preeminent and sufficient. There was a kind of false teaching that had come into the city of Colossae, and Paul writes about it even though he's never visited Colossae. And it's interesting, as you read this letter to the Colossians, you get little glimpses of what that false teaching was. And, you know, it was a strange mixture of Judaism and what we might today call theosophy with a little bit of the worship of the powers thrown in, or by means of discipline you might be able to catch an experience that would unite you with the angels in their worship, a strange mixture, but really much in common with the New Age thinking of our own time. And so it's a good epistle for us to reflect on when you see what the Christian faith really means. And there you have Paul's commission. His commission to minister the mystery of Jesus Christ, to make known to the nations Jesus Christ, and to that end, the struggle in which Paul must be engaged. And that's our charge to Skip this morning, to proclaim Jesus Christ. We proclaim him, teaching and admonishing everyone with all wisdom, to proclaim him, and then also to be prepared to suffer in doing so. To this end I labor, struggling with all his energy, which so powerfully works in me. Think for a moment about the glory of the gospel mystery, the mystery of Jesus Christ. Paul says in this passage that was read, that the mystery that he preaches had been kept hidden for ages and generations, but is now disclosed to the saints. You see, Paul's view of history is very different from that which is the view of the mind of modernity. Paul sees history in terms of God's revelation and God's redemption. Paul looks back across the ages from the very days of creation, and he sees God at work, redeeming fallen mankind after the sin in the garden. He sees the call of Abraham. He sees the Exodus. He sees the people being brought into the land, and he sees always the promise that God would use his people to reach out to the nations of the world. And he sees the sin of Israel and their exile and the judgment. But then he hears the promises of what God will do, the incredible blessings that God will finally bring. And in the wisdom of God, God's plan will be realized. And of course, the Apostle Paul is proclaiming that it's happened. God's plan has been realized. God's wisdom has been made known. And made known in a way that even the angels can't understand. For the very Son of God comes into the world. He comes into the world, how? Born of a virgin, laid in a feed bin, hidden in obscurity, from which he emerges to speak as no man ever spoke, to do miracles such as no one had ever done, to bid the storms to cease, to stand outside a tomb and say, "Lazarus, come forth," and see the dead emerge from the very bonds of death. the reality of the fulfillment of the promise of God in the coming of the Lord of the mystery, Jesus Christ. And you see in this passage and what precedes it, how Paul has been describing the wonder of Christ's own person. Verse 15 of this first chapter, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. These teachers that had been corrupting the faith of the Colossian church were very much interested in the powers, the things invisible. And Paul says Jesus Christ is over them all. He's the creator of all things, visible and invisible. He's the sustainer of all things, for in him all things hold together. He's the Lord of all, who is above all and supreme. In fact, he's nothing less than God over all, God incarnate, that in him the full deity dwells bodily. Jesus Christ, the incarnate Lord. And then he describes the work of Jesus Christ and tells us how Jesus Christ went to the cross to accomplish his reconciling death. Verse 19, for God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. My, through his blood on the cross. Paul speaks of all these mysterious heavenly realities, of the glory of Jesus Christ, of the deity of Jesus Christ. And then he links it with this incredible thing, his death as a criminal, his blood pouring down from his body on the cross. You know, Paul was once Saul, the proud Pharisee, persecuting the church, and he was sure that Jesus could not be the Messiah. It was perfectly evident that he couldn't be, because the Old Testament in the book of Deuteronomy says, cursed is everyone that is hanged or hung on a tree. Jesus had been put up on a cross. He was hung on a tree. So obviously he was cursed, and a cursed one couldn't be the Messiah. And then Jesus met Saul on the road to Damascus, showed him his glory, and he had to completely reverse his thinking. For he found that Jesus was not only the Messiah in spite of the fact that he had been accursed, he found out that he was the Messiah precisely because he had been made the curse. He who knew no sin, Paul tells us, was made sin for us. Was made the curse for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. The cross was foolishness to the Greek, crucified, deity. But it wasn't foolish to the dark powers, because Paul tells us that by the cross, Jesus Christ overcame them. In the second chapter in verse 14, he says, having canceled the written code with its regulations that was against us and that stood opposed to us, he took it away, nailing it to the cross. And having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. The cross, in the midst of its shame, was a triumph. In the Gospel of John, the cross is always spoken of as part of Christ's glory. He was lifted up on the cross, and the lifting up of a few feet from the ground was the beginning of his lifting up to glory. He triumphed at the cross, and there was displayed the wisdom of God, foolishness to men, but the wisdom of God, where justice and love met, where the grace of God was manifested, where God's name was glorified. The mystery of Christ. Paul tells us that Christ is for us. He says that when Christ was crucified, we were crucified with him. When he was raised, we were raised with him. The third chapter of this book, since then you have been raised with Christ, Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. And then he goes on to say, set your mind on things above, not on earthly things, for you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. You see, we are joined to Christ. He's our representative. We're united to him. It's Christ for you, and there lies your hope. And it's Christ with you. We are with him because he is with us. And Paul tells us in this epistle, we are to do all things in the name of Jesus Christ. Christ for you, Christ with you. And then in this passage, the mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. What a wonderful gospel. That Christ represented us, died for us. That Christ is with us by the power of his Spirit. But more than that, that there's that vital union with Jesus Christ. And Paul can only say that Christ is in us. Oh, friends, what we need for the new century is not a new myth. What we need is the solemn truth of the gospel, the wonder of it, the glory of it. Not that we get united with vegetables in the mystery of life, but that we are united to God the Son, Christ in you, the hope of glory. And friends, that wonderful message of the mystery of Christ requires, as you've already heard from other speakers, requires labor. Paul says, we proclaim him, admonishing and teaching everyone with all wisdom. To this end I labor, struggling with all his energy, which so powerfully works in me. You see, Paul fulfills the gospel in his labor, in his proclaiming of Jesus Christ. He says earlier that he wants to fulfill the gospel in the word of the cross that he preaches. In the NIV, it's translated to preach the gospel in its fullness, but literally it's to fulfill the gospel. And Paul means that in a very special sense. He fulfills the gospel in its power and scope, as he said in the book of Romans in the 15th chapter in verse 19, where we hear the apostle tell us that he's obeyed God by the power of signs and miracles through the power of the Spirit from Jerusalem all the way around to Illyricum. I have fully proclaimed the gospel of Christ. And there again, it's the same word. I have fulfilled the gospel of Christ. You see how he fulfilled it? In the power of the Spirit. You see how he fulfilled it? In the scope, out to all the nations. That's what you've been hearing. From here in Dallas out to the world, the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it's apostolic realization, because the apostle knew that he was stepping onto the stage of the great history of redemption. The apostle quotes from Isaiah and says, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. Now the hidden is revealed. Now there is a light shining to the Gentiles. And the apostle Paul saw himself as identified with the servant of the Lord in the prophecy of Isaiah, that he was one bringing light to the Gentiles, that he was causing those to see to whom no tidings had come. He has a role to play in the history of redemption. And Christian brothers and sisters, we enter into that role, you see. There's a significance to history. There's a meaning. There's a reason why the Lord God has put us here in this time. And the reason is not to fabricate a new mythology. The reason is to proclaim the gospel. The reason is to see the glory of Jesus Christ and make him known to the nations. Cause them to hear to whom no tidings came. Fulfill the gospel which is God's great purpose. Why does Paul have to fulfill it? Because it's God's own purpose. If you look at the passage that was read this morning and what goes right before it, you see that this is exactly what God has been doing. He has been performing this wonder, and the Apostle Paul is entering into it. And then you'll notice that fulfilling the gospel includes for Paul presenting everyone perfect in Jesus Christ. Now, that's a bit much, isn't it? Present everyone perfect in Jesus Christ? Skip, if we give you that charge this morning and you look out in this congregation, how are you going to set about presenting everyone perfect in Jesus Christ? And Paul was writing to a church he'd never even visited. But he was struggling and laboring to present everyone perfect. You know, I must confess that I've been convicted by this passage. I must acknowledge that, yes, I've had zeal for evangelism to bring people to Christ. And yes, I realize that in the last day, when Jesus Christ comes again, we'll all see him and we'll all be like him. But this business of maturing every individual Christian, this business of Christian nurture, this business of bringing people forward in their walk with Christ, is that necessary too? And the Apostle Paul says, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, why? Why? If the Lord's going to make us all perfect in the last day and we're saved now, why worry about what happens in the meantime? See, that's not how the apostle looks at it. No, he wants us to be getting ready now. He wants us to be working on it now. And the work of the gospel ministry is to lead you forward in your own growth in grace, admonishing and teaching everyone with all wisdom, so that we may present everyone perfect in Jesus Christ. And that calls for labor of the most intense kind. You know, I've had the joy of being associated with Skip for 6 years as an associate pastor with him, and of course, a long association before that. But I've seen Skip just weary almost to death. I've seen Skip, putting on a forced smile when he was too tired to talk. I've seen him squaring his shoulders to go into another difficult interview. I've seen him paying a price. And every pastor, every true minister of the gospel daily pays the price. And the Apostle Paul paid that price preeminently. He says that he rejoices in what was suffered for you. I fill up in my flesh that was still lacking in regard to Christ's affliction. Now, the lack in Christ's afflictions doesn't mean that there was anything lacking in the sufferings of Jesus Christ for us. Paul has told us how complete that was. No, the lack refers to what the rabbis called the messianic woes, going back to the book of Daniel, where the sufferings are predicted before the time of the coming of the Messiah. And the Apostle Paul says there's a limit to those sufferings that the church will endure, as Jesus himself taught us. And therefore, I'm fulfilling up, well, my part of it, and I'm glad if I can fulfill a little more than my part of the total suffering that the church must endure for Christ. And the Apostle Paul says, I'm glad to do it. And every minister needs to say, I'm glad to do it. And Skip needs to say that too. You know, amazingly, in the Bible, the talk of joy is always linked to the talk of suffering, affliction, enduring, persevering. But friends, it does bring joy. As we mean it, as we labor in it, as we give ourselves to the cause of Jesus Christ, we discover afresh what it means. Christ in you, the hope of glory. The apostle lifts his eyes, no longer blinded, to see with unveiled face the glory of the Lord. Skip, let Christ be your vision. See his glory and labor to make him known.